Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. I'm very pleased to have as our guest today, Julia Spencer Fleming. We're going to be discussing her Claire Ferguson, Russ Van Alstyne mysteries. And first of all, Julia, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Casey.
Now, did I pronounce Russ's last name right?
You did.
Okay. Let's go back to the start of the series. Julia, and In the Bleak Midwinter was the first novel that you wrote that was published, and it won the Agatha Award for the Best First Mystery and the Anthony Award.
Mm-hmm.
And the character of Claire Ferguson, why don't you tell us kind of the genesis of her character and how you came to discover her voice?
Well, I knew I wanted to write about issues of spirituality, for one, not in a proselytizing sort of way, but in an exploratory way. What's it like to be a person who's motivated by essentially a force outside of yourself in a very secular society? And I knew I also wanted to write about this small town, and I knew I wanted to write about someone who is an insider and yet also an outsider. And, of course, a lot of times we tend to treat clerics, priests or ministers or rabbis or what have you, as the role and not as a human being. Certainly in a small town, a priest or minister knows things about people who live in that town that others might not, is going to be there in moments of crisis, is expected to take a role in social issues in the town. But at the same time, there is very frequently a kind of distance between that individual and the people around her, in Claire's case. Because, of course, what we all see is the collar, in this case, and it stops. People who are professional religious get defined by the role, and that creates that space. And I was very interested in that sense of insider and outsider.
Yes, and Julia, if you would, for the listeners, some people, if they're not familiar with the Episcopal faith, priests, women priests, sometimes people are not familiar, really, that the fact that
right.
women are ordained.
Right. In the Episcopal Church, we have bishops and priests, and an ordination that would not look dissimilar from the outside to, I think, a lot of Catholics, for instance. But, of course, the Episcopal Church has accepted the ordination of women since 1979, and it's becoming increasingly common. I understand that, for instance, now the seminaries are something like 35% to 40% female at this point.
Yes, and tell us a bit about your background. When I was looking at your biography, I see that you studied acting and history as an undergraduate, and how has the study of acting influenced your writing, do you think?
It's actually influenced me quite a bit. I think in the process, the way that I write, I often see the scenes playing out, and I think this is common for a lot of writers, almost as if it was a play or a motion picture occurring in front of me, and then, of course, my role is to transcribe that in the best way that I can. But I also think that the sort of work that I did, studying as an actor, and I was an actor's equity apprentice and worked professionally, you do a lot of work on finding character and finding the touch marks of character, little things that are present that help clarify that character in the mind of the audience. And I bring that to my work as a writer. Now, you know, I was really disappointed in a lot of ways when I decided that acting was not for me. I was good, but I wasn't that good at it. And it's one of those professions where if you're not in the top 1%, you're never going to make a living at it. And it's funny that now I find myself being in the position of kind of being the actor, director, script writer, stage setter. I have total control over my performances, so I enjoy that a lot.
Yes, I could see that. Now, Claire Ferguson, the development of her character through A Fountain Filled with Blood, then Out of the Deep I Cry, which received an Edgar nomination for Best Novel of 2004, which will be awarded in April of 2005. That, and then we'll also be discussing To Darkness and to Death, which will be published on June third of 05. How did the character of Russ Van Alstyne develop as in a companionship with Claire in your mind?
Well, in some ways, he was the counterpoint to Claire. You know, once I had this woman who was younger and from away, she's a southerner in a northern town, she is a faithful person, I needed someone to counterbalance her. So Russ started to develop in my imagination. He was obviously a man. He's older. He's a hometown boy who's returned after decades away in the military. He's an agnostic, if not an outright atheist. He's very skeptical, where she is to the point of being naive about human nature sometimes. They're really a yin and yang, but at the same time, they have a lot of the kind of underlying foundation points of their personalities are very much alike, and that gives them a commonality. And as I started writing them, that became clearer and clearer to me, that there was, in fact, despite the fact that they were very disparate from the outside, there was a deep underlying similarity. And so as I wrote, they started making connections with one another.
Yeah,
which,
and it's,
has turned out to be the big deal in the series, much to my surprise.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Did you, and just so the listeners, this is a relationship that develops over time, and there's an attraction there, and I'm sure that's created some interesting situations and dilemmas for you as a writer in terms of how far you're letting this go in the series.
Well, Russ is, as he described himself early on, a very married man. And Claire is certainly trying very hard to stay true to her ethical beliefs and also to fulfill this role that she perceives for herself as being someone who has to be a role model for her congregation. So, yeah, it is. It's kind of a little bit of exquisite torture, but it's, to my mind, far more interesting than the sort of series where, you know, the amateur sleuth meets the detective in the first book, and they're dating in the second book, and by the fourth book they're planning the wedding, and by the sixth book they're having their first child. I really found myself fascinated by the concept of this very grown-up, very ambiguous relationship where two people who do not want to do wrong or hurt others find themselves increasingly attracted despite their own ethical and moral underpinnings. And another thing that I felt was very important is to make Russ someone who had a very contented marriage. Most of the time that I've read fiction where you have someone who's attracted to another person outside the marriage, inevitably it seems that the spouse is either, you know, this horrible, ravening person that you could never imagine our hero being married to, or the hero is actually a villain and he winds up, you know, getting it in some horrible way before the third act. And I wanted to have a situation that was more complicated than that, and more, I think, true to life, that people can be devoted and comfortable and happy with their spouses, and yet, in as happens to Russ, find this recognition of themselves in another person.
Yes.
And then, of course, the dilemma is, what do you do with it? Where do you go with that?
Yeah, and one of the things I like about the series is that they don't. It's a very open relationship. They're not trying to keep this a secret or hiding it from the community, because you really don't know what they would be hiding if they did hide something.
Yes, well, and they haven't. They're trying very hard not to. But again, I've gotten a lot of mail from readers who say thank you for not having them jump into bed together. I think well, that's not really in their characters, is it? And I think whatever you do, it needs to be true to the characters as they grow and develop.
Yes. Now, let's talk for a moment about Out of the Deep I Cry, which will be available in paperback on May 3rd of 05. And with one of the things that I really liked about Out of the Deep I Cry was the time frame that you set the novel in. It actually takes place in four different eras, and the chapters, I believe there are 42 chapters, are titled Now and Then.
Mm-hmm.
And how did this come up in your mind, and what were the challenges as a writer of framing the novel in those different time periods?
Well, I was very attracted to the idea of the bad thing that happened in the past that is still affecting people's lives, perhaps without them even consciously being aware of it. I'm a big, big fan of Sharon McCrums, who uses that as a theme in a lot of her works. And so when it came time for me to try that, I had to struggle with how to present a coherent story that's really in some ways two stories. We have what's going on in the present and, of course, what's going on in the past. And the way I envisioned it was a kind of a scoop, as we scoop out pieces of the past, because the first scene takes place in 1969, and then we're in the present, and then we go back into the 50s, and then we go back further into the 30s, and finally we reach the bad thing that happened near the very end of the book. On a technical note, keeping track of the chronology was the most challenging thing. What I wound up doing was a very long timeline going from the 1800s, when the earliest characters were born, right through until the present, and putting everybody on it and putting everything that was going on, both things that the readers see right up front and the things, of course, that remain hidden. And that helped me to grapple the material, to keep control of it. One of the things that I try to do for myself as a writer is challenge myself in every book to do something different. I don't want to keep writing the same story, the same sort of way over and over again. So that was the challenge that I set for myself was to do a story that took place in multiple time periods in some way and have it come out as a seamless whole.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we discuss To Darkness and to Death, the Edgar nomination, how has that influenced your career? I read where you're being now, you're being published in Germany, Japan, Denmark. Was this a result of the Edgar nomination, Julia, or was this something that took place before the nomination?
No, that took place before. I think the Edgar nomination is recent enough in time, so I really haven't seen the repercussions of it, other than there's been an increased media interest. I've done interviews. I think that getting nominated for an Edgar, which it sounds cliche, but truly is such an honor, I think that in some ways that's a very long-lasting simmering effect. I think that it's something that people remember for many years into your career, and I think it shades the way that people, certainly in the publishing world, view you in your work. It lends a certain, you know, gravitas to it. Oh, you're serious. You got an Edgar nomination, which is very nice. It's very flattering.
Yes, and well deserved. Let's move on to Darkness and Death, which is the fourth novel in this series, which will be published by Sam Martin's on June 3rd of 2005. And where your previous novel, you had a very long time horizon, To Darkness and to Death takes place in the course of a single day. And why don't you tell us a bit about how you came up with this approach?
This was the first time I really came up with the I hate to use the word gimmick, but that's the one that leads to mind first. I was looking specifically for something that would be different from the previous book, from Out of the Deep I Cry, and I thought, well, what could be more different? If you're looking for a contrast, telling a story from 70 years' point of view, than to try something that takes place in 24 hours, actually in less than 24 hours, as it turned out. And I was also very attracted to trying to write something that was more thriller-like, in the sense that there's a ticking ticking clock element going on. We know that something's going to happen at the end of the day, and we're racing to find out what it is. And I also, in some ways, it's the least whodunit esque, if that's a word, of any of my books. I've become very interested as I've been writing in the effects of crime on people, both the victims and the people around them, and the people who perpetrate it. And so there are several crimes that happen in To Darkness and to Death that we see. We see the perpetrator before, during, after, and a lot of it is about someone who's made a horrible, horrible mistake, and then, oh my God, what am I going to do about it? And we follow that.
Yeah. Now, Claire Ferguson has a very eclectic background, as do you, and she also has a very good understanding of the military and a lot of outdoors type activities, and that comes into play a lot in To Darkness and to Death. And how did this evolve in your writing?
It started out because when I was coming up with Claire at her birth, as it were, I knew that I wanted her to be a strong, dynamic, take charge sort of person, not just in terms of leadership in her parish, but also somebody who could get into trouble and get herself out of it, and someone who would feel physically confident in what she was doing, and even have a sense of daring. And so that also led to a trait that I have seen in a lot of military, I'll say officers, because that's what I'm most familiar with, who are involved in more high-risk occupations, as Claire was. She was a helicopter pilot. Have this interesting combination. On one hand, they can be extremely precise and methodical when it comes to their work, but on the other hand, they're attracted to this sort of work in the first place because they tend to be very high-risk takers. And so Claire developed into this person who has those two combinations. You know, she is both, she's obviously a very caring and empathetic person, and that is part of her role as a priest, but she also is, as she describes herself, an adrenaline junkie. And she is not only averse to risk, in some ways she needs it and she enjoys it, which, of course, as the plots roll out, lead her to leaping into situations that she otherwise might not get into.
Yes, and that's Russ Van Alstyne is very much cut from the same cloth that way. And I notice that on To Darkness and to Death, it's titled A Claire Ferguson, Russ Van Alstyne Mystery, and they kind of have joint billing. And do you find that you get more mail and interest in Claire than you do Russ, or is what's the percentage, would you say?
I get a lot of mail about both of them, mm-hmm. as a couple, as a team. I'm getting an increasing amount of mail from male readers, which is very, very good. I'm very happy for that. And I always viewed it as a book about, as book stories about the two of them as a team. I tell my stories from multiple points of view, and so I very frequently will have a close third person point of view from Russ's telling the story in one chapter, and then we'll switch to Claire for another chapter. And I actually try to keep tabs of that roughly as I'm writing and break it down so that not one or the other is dominating, but they're both sharing the stage equally.
Mm-hmm.
I love writing both their voices. They're both very, very different in terms of my word choice, action, what each one of them notices, their physical responses. And as a writer, it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a moment about Miller's Kill, because as in all good mystery series, the city or the village or town where the stories take place becomes a character of the series. And Miller's Kill is a very interesting small town, and you've gotten very good reviews for your use of Miller's Kill. And when you were starting out on this path with the first book and leading to the second, was how did you go about the conscious decision of how big you were going to make the town and the characters, how many characters you were going to have and the stories and that kind of thing?
Well, I knew from the first that Miller's Kill was itself going to be like another character. I want the environment to be another character. And in fact, when I started out, before I ever had a plot for my first book, In the Bleak Midwinter, I had a biography of Claire, a biography of Russ, and a biography of the town. It's based very heavily on towns near what I call my family's town. My mother's side of the family settled a small town called Argyle, New York, back in the 1720s, and have, up until recently, had a continuous presence there. And when I was a girl, and we moved around quite a bit because we were in the military, Argyle, New York was this place that we would always come back to. You know, it was the holidays and the vacations, and when we got out of the military, we settled there for a few years in my very, very early teens. And I think it had an enormous resonant effect on me. I think there is something about the place that you are in the years when you're 12, 13, 14, before you really get involved in the distractions of teenage and adult life, that stays with you. I think that's one of the reasons that there's so many books out there about that stage of life. And for me, it's the place where I was in that stage of life. And I made Miller's Kill an amalgam, an imaginary town, because I did not want to have to tie myself down to being literally true. And at the same time, I wanted to give it a very, very accurate feel. So if you've read my books and you've read about Miller's Kill and you go driving through Washington County or Warren County or Northern Saratoga County in New York State, which is the place that I'm writing about, you're going to recognize those towns. All of those towns are going to look like Miller's Kill to you.
Yeah, and I really I come from Eastern Ohio, and there's kind of some parallels there as well. I can see some of that, that I grew up in a small town, and part of the To Darkness and to Death deals with a lot of the changes that a lot of these small towns are going through, doesn't it? In terms of the globalization and the pressure on businesses to be competitive, and families that pass their businesses on from generation to generation, that creates a real problem for small towns, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's one of the things that interests me. You see it in the Adirondacks, the area that I write about. I see it here in Maine, where I live, and it's something that has a certain universality to it, and it's something that I find very compelling. What do people do when they're run over by, you know, giant machines of commerce that have no relationship to their lives? You know, things that are happening thousands of miles away that affect not just the way that you make your living, but how you raise your family and what your hopes for their future are. And of course, the other thing that I think that To Darkness and to Death is about is the interconnectedness that you have in these small towns, where one way or another, everyone is involved with everyone else. They either went to school together, or they're blood relations, or they work together, or your job is dependent on Joe's job, who is dependent on Bob's job, and that there's really no escaping that web of connectedness.
Mm-hmm. And with the small town, two, the church life, it tends to be a very important part of that. And one of the things that I think that you do very effectively is that the readers of your novels, you don't have to be a regular churchgoer, a person of faith per se, to understand the stories and to enjoy the novels, because I think the themes that you're writing about are universal in nature.
I hope so. I've gotten a mail that I appreciate a lot from people who say, well, I'm not religious or I don't go to church, but I really enjoy your stories. I really understand what's going on. Because, of course, part of the issue, certainly from Claire's point of view, is how does her faith affect what she's going to do? But on a strictly practical level, a lot of the things that happen in a church are no different than the stuff that we all experience in whatever organization we're in. You know, there's political fighting going on. There's always a problem with how much money do we have. There's who's in and who's out, and who do you have to kiss up to get where you want to go. And that, again, is something that people see all around them, not just by going to church, because that's not what it's supposed to be about.
Yeah. You know, when you started the series, Julia, there was no way you could have foreseen a lot of changes that the Episcopal Church in particular is going through, but it's really been a very interesting period of time to write about that particular church, hasn't it?
It has been. I caught the wave, as it were, in an entirely unexpected fashion when my second book, A Fountain Filled with Blood, came out in May, and that June or July, I think it was, the Triennial Episcopal Convention decided that they would, in fact, respect the wishes of the congregations of New Hampshire and ratify the election of the first openly gay bishop into the Episcopal Church. This has made worldwide news, and it's still kicking up a great big cloud of dust. But I can tell you, after that decision, my phone did not stop ringing. I probably did 25 or 30 radio interviews that summer. I think anybody who Googled gay plus Episcopalian came up with A Fountain Filled with Blood, because, of course, part of the story that occurs there is a gay bashing, and how does Claire and how does her congregation deal with it, and how does the community deal with it?
Yeah, I can imagine that with the advent of the internet, and like you say, the Google searches, it really is amazing how these things come together. Now, going forward, Julia, with Claire and Russ, and like we say, we're talking about the darkness into death. What are your plans going forward here as far as the series goes?
My plan is for the series to wrap up within 6 books. Right now I have a contract from St. Martin's for 6 books in the series and a 7th book to be named. And I have a story arc plotted out for them that goes over the course of 6 books. I think that it's very important to get to the story question. Every story has a central question. And sometimes the question is, will Scarlett save Tara and find the man she loves? And sometimes the question is, will Frodo throw the ring into Mount Doom and save the land? And sometimes, as in the case of my series, the question is, will these two honest and honorable people find some way of being together, or will they have to part forever? And once you answer the question, the story is over. That's what makes fiction so satisfying. It's not going on and on. There is an answer to the question. And you can't let people dangle forever. I don't think it's fair to my readers, and I don't think it's true to the progress of the story. You know, when people get tangled up in thorny and complicated emotional issues, they don't drag on year after year. Sooner or later, something gives. And so I want to stay true to that. It's a little bit scary, in all honesty, because people love this series. They love the characters of Claire Ferguson and Russ Van Alstyne. It's a little bit nerve-wracking wondering if readers are going to want to read something that I write that is not about those two characters. But at the same time, I don't want to get caught in, where we're doing Russ and Claire, volume 14, and it's yet another account of them casting each other wistful glances across coffee at the Creamy Cakes diner. You need to come to some sort of resolution.
You know, I really appreciate that as a reader, that you have that honesty and that understanding, and I think that is probably one of the things that makes the series so good, is that you have that the reader in mind as you're writing, which I think is
a good thing. Well, the other nice thing about that is having in my mind that it's not going to be something that I'm going to be working on forever, is it kind of frees me up. I don't have to keep characters around forever. Sometimes there's a safety. You know if you're reading a series that goes on and on and on, it is very unlikely that any of the main characters are going to die or leave town or in some way permanently seriously change. And I don't have those constraints writing a series that I know is going to be completed within 6 books.
Mm-hmm.
So I tell people everything's on the table. Don't count on anything.
That's wonderful. So one of the things I like to do is to wrap up is that you've had a very interesting background. We haven't mentioned the fact that you have a law degree. What has been, if you, when you're talking to aspiring writers and readers, what has been the most pleasant surprise, would you say, with all of your training and background of being a novelist who now is achieving the recognition that you've had? And what would you say to the listeners out there who aspire to be writers?
Well, I'd say probably the most pleasant surprise is the interaction with the readers. You write a story for yourself, and then to find characters that started in my imagination coming to life and taking on their own existence in other people's hearts and minds. It's delightful. I had no idea before I was published what that experience was like. As far as my advice to aspiring writers, I usually say two things. One is go out and get a copy of Lawrence Block's book, Telling Lies for Fun and Profit. It is, to my mind, one of the best books, concise books about writing ever. And the other is you need to do it. You need to sit down every day and write. When I was writing In the Bleak Midwinter, during the course of writing that, I went from being a stay-at-home mom of two to working full-time in a law firm and a mom of three. And I, for a long time, was getting up at 4:30 in the morning, and I'd write from 4:30 until 6:30. And then my kids would get up and my day would start. If you really want to do it, you can really carve out time somewhere, even if it's just an hour a day. I was really lucky because I had good friends who gave me so much encouragement when I was starting out, when it was just a pipe dream. But those people really said, you can do it, and supported me. And so it's also good to find people like that in your life, somebody who really believes in you as a writer and can say, yes, are you doing it? Probably not unlike having a diet and exercise buddy, when I think about it. But somebody that you're accountable to.
Mm-hmm. Juliet, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule, and I think you have another successful novel, Into Darkness, Into Death, and I really look forward to keeping up with you and finding out where you go as a writer as your career develops. And thank you so much for giving us the time you have today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.